Hello, this is Heidi, and I will be reading from the May edition of Guideposts this morning. Something beautiful under new beginnings. All I wanted was a house in a quiet, idyllic setting. Then everything started to go wrong. By Peggy Frezon, Rexford, New York. I poked my head out the side door of the house. Our dream house, my husband and I had thought when we moved in 2 years earlier. I flipped the switch to the lamppost in the yard. Nothing. Flipped it again. Still nothing. It's not working, I called to Mike. After everything we'd already fixed here, this glitch was beyond frustrating. Mike came around the corner of the house, tools in hand. The lights in the back won't work either, he said. I changed the bulbs and the outlets. There must be a broken wire somewhere underground. Add it to the list. I've been so sure God had led us to this peaceful home in the country. Now I felt like that guy in Greek mythology, condemned to push a boulder uphill every day for eternity. As soon as we got one thing fixed, something else broke. To save money, we'd done a lot of the work ourselves, but repairs such as replacing underground wiring were above our pay grade. For more than 30 years, Mike and I had dreamed of moving from our home in the city, where neighbors crowded in on all sides, to a secluded place with room to breathe and a big yard for our golden retrievers, Pete and Ernest. At last, this time seemed right. We met with a mortgage officer at the bank and set a budget. The houses I liked most were out of our price range. We made offers on a couple others, but were immediately outbid. I took to praying every day as I looked at the latest listings online. God, please show us the house that's right for us. I specifically asked him to find us a little house in the country. Nothing fancy. I just want to wake up, look out the window, and see something beautiful. One day, as we were driving away from another disappointing showing, I spied a for sale sign in front of a cute, tan, cottage-style house with red shutters. The yard was so large it was more like a field, with a lovely apple tree out front. This is it, Mike said. The next day, we toured the house with a real estate agent. I looked out the big window in the primary bedroom and gasped. The lush green backyard seemed to go on forever, and on the right stood the tallest weeping willow I'd ever seen, like God putting an exclamation mark on this place. The price was at the very top of our budget, but our offer was accepted. On a perfect July day in 2021, we moved in. Ernest and Pete roamed the yard, tags wailing, as happy as they were. I took particular delight in strolling out to our mailbox. I'd always wanted a mailbox by the road. That meant we were in the country. Bright orange daylilies and Queen Anne's lace grew beside the post. Bullfrogs croaked in the tall grass. We were living the dream. It wasn't long before we noticed things weren't working the way they should. The air conditioning, the washing machine, electrical outlets. We were so busy settling in that we learned to live with the house's idiosyncrasies. They just added to the charm, I told myself. In November, a technician from the heating company inspected the pellet furnace that supplemented our oil furnace.
Your vent pipe needs to be replaced, he said. It's rusted through.
The work took him half the day. Still, I was shocked by the bill. What was that pipe made of, gold? I grumbled. Days later, Mike was in the shower when I heard him yell, What happened? The water's freezing cold. He trudged down to the basement, hair dripping, and discovered the water heater had died.
It couldn't be repaired. We paid for a new one to be installed and for the old one to be drained and removed. Shortly before Thanksgiving, the furnace conked out. The repairs left me with another bill. Part of me wished we had never moved. Our city house was 100 years old, twice the age of this one, and we hadn't had nearly as many problems. I found Mike sitting out on the deck, the dogs keeping him company. How could he relax at a time like this? This house is costing us just too much, I said, shaking the latest bills for emphasis. Unexpected things are bound to come up, Mike said. Don't worry. Come sit here with me. I plopped down beside him. Easy for Mike to say not to worry. He was a laid-back type. I was just the opposite. I needed life to be orderly. My home was supposed to be my refuge. God knew this. Why had he directed me to a house that was anything but? There are a lot of positives to this house, Mike said. After more than four decades together, he could practically read my mind. You love the rustic barn wood wall in the living room. The kitchen appliances are new, and we have two bathrooms for the first time ever. All true. Then I tallied up all the repair bills we'd paid on top of the mortgage payments that were already a stretch for us. How long before something else went wrong? Amazingly, for more than a year, nothing broke. I thanked God and let myself relax and enjoy our new home. New Year's morning, 2023. Mike and I padded down the stairs. It sure is cold, I said. Turn up the heat. The furnace didn't kick on, even after Mike pressed the reset button. We called the technician. At least you don't need your whole furnace replaced, just the control panel, he said after hours of work at a holiday rate. But start saving up. It's going to go out sooner or later. The furnace survived the winter. Now, standing at our side door, I was more worried about the issues with our outdoor lights. Mike installed yet another outlet and covered it with a waterproof box. Nope. Finally, we called an electrician. It took only a few minutes of poking around under our deck for him to find the problem. This wiring is badly frayed, he said. See how the wood here has been burned? I'm surprised you didn't go up in flames. How many times had Mike and I sat on that deck? That evening, I vented to Mike. This is supposed to be the home God set aside for us, not a money pit. And you heard the repair guy. We're lucky we didn't have a fire. Mike pulled me close. We're going to be okay, he said. God doesn't promise that we won't have challenges, but he will be with us through all of them. You have to trust. I'll try, I said, squeezing him back. A few months later, I walked down the stairs to the basement with a basket of laundry, only to step into a pool of water. The sump pump had broken. This is what trust gets me, I muttered. Water crept up the sides of boxes of Christmas decorations, photo albums, things we hadn't yet unpacked. Technicians worked frantically to install a new sump pump while Mike and I mopped and tried to salvage what we could. I had some choice words for God when I fell into bed that night. Why was it that you brought us here to this house? I said. Because I'm not seeing it. What am I missing? I was so tired, I slept in the next morning. I opened my eyes to a ray of sun streaming into the bedroom. It drew me to the big window. Sunlight filtered through tall pine trees in our backyard. I looked to the right. There was the willow, its long flowing branches swaying in the breeze, a red-tailed hawk soaring over it. I gasped, just as I had the day we toured the house. This time, it wasn't only the view that took my breath away. Hadn't I told God I wanted to wake up, look out the window, and see something beautiful? He had given me everything I'd asked for and more. What had I been missing? I had forgotten about gratitude in all things. Mike and I had endured far more serious problems in our life than pricey home repairs. The Lord had seen us through them all. Surely, I could trust him now. Mike was out on the deck with his newspaper, watching the dogs play in the yard. Peace and contentment settled over me. Together, at our little house in the country, there was no other place I would rather be. I opened the window and called out, "I'll be right down." And our next story is under Overcoming Addiction, entitled Deliverance Alley. A clear, quiet voice in the still of the evening led this drug user from the streets to a life of service, by Rhonda Willingham of Dallas, Texas. The place I call Deliverance Alley is a vacant lot of grass and dirt in a neglected South Dallas neighborhood. Drive by and you won't see much. A sign on a deli across the street reads, "No trespassing, prostitution, drug dealing, loitering, weapons, or criminal activity will be tolerated." Why do I call this seemingly godforsaken slice of scarred urban ground Deliverance Alley? What if I said it's where God delivered me one afternoon almost 2 decades ago? When I landed in Deliverance Alley, I wasn't just homeless. I was far from home in every possible way. I'd been born into a military family in Kansas City, Missouri. My dad, Wendell Jean Parker, a lieutenant colonel in the Army. My mother, Mary Ann Parker, raised me and 3 younger brothers. My dad served in Korea and Vietnam. I was 5 when he was transferred to a base in Europe. It was in the 1960s. Dad was up front with me and my siblings about the advantages of moving to Europe. "We are a black family," he said. "There is a lot less racism over there than in America." Sad but true. The military was one of the nation's first major institutions to desegregate. On our base in Europe, I played with kids regardless of skin color. We traveled to European cities on vacations, visited art museums, and learned German. Teachers at school taught us about the realities of slavery and the many contributions made by black people to American life. Everything changed when we returned stateside in the early 1970s. Just off the plane in South Carolina, I noticed white, quote-unquote, and colored, quote-unquote, signs on the restrooms. That was illegal, but the airport didn't seem to care. My father always spoke his mind, and I am every inch his daughter. "Excuse me," I said to a passerby, pointing at the whites-only bathroom. "What color do I have to be to go in there?" The woman regarded me with an expression of utter disdain. "How dare you," she seemed to say before stalking off. Dad yanked me right out of that airport. "You have no idea what you're doing," he hissed. "You could get us all killed." We settled in Texas, where my father was promoted to assistant commanding officer at Fort Hood and bought a house in Dallas for Mom and us kids. My brothers were good kids and had jobs after school,
but they were still harassed by police almost every day. Living in a constant state of fear wears you down. I told Dad I wanted to join the army, but he said it was no place for a woman. I turned my back and moved to New York. I worked as a customer service manager for telecom companies. I made good money. There was one problem. Remember how I said I was my father's daughter? That had a downside. Dad parented my brothers and me with military discipline. We followed a schedule, did chores, and never talked back. Every weekend, he made us straighten up our rooms like little soldiers. We had to clean, fold, and put away everything. When I say clean, I mean even the baseboards. I chafed under Dad's rules and told him I wasn't in the Army. I even wrote him a letter when I was little telling him I was glad he'd been sent to Vietnam because now I didn't have to clean my room. Imagine receiving such a letter from your child. On my own for the first time in New York, I gave free rein to my contrarian side. I partied on weekends and enjoyed the nightlife. I met and married a man who'd seen combat in the military, but his PTSD contributed to him abusing me physically. I had to leave that marriage for fear of my life. I returned to Dallas and met another man. I fell hard. They say love is blind. Tell me about it. I didn't even realize at first that he sold drugs. He was good-looking and seemed to do well financially, and he treated me like a queen. Turned out he was riding the 1980s cocaine wave by cooking and selling crack. I can't explain why, but at some point I decided to join him. Maybe it was that misguided love, more desperation than devotion. I started doing drugs myself and dealing. I had been raised in church, and I believed in God. I knew I was violating every moral principle Mom and Dad had tried to instill in me. I was aware that I had crossed a line and might never be able to turn back. So many addicts can't. That is what addiction does to you. It takes over your life, totally. Eventually, even the drugs couldn't dull my shame and self-loathing. To this day, I am haunted by the name, by the time a little girl, just a wisp of a thing, came to the door of a crack house I ran. "Is my mama here?" she asked. "We're hungry and she took our food stamps." The woman had tried to sell the food stamps for drug money. "Go take care of your kids," I screamed at her, surprised by my rage, but I went right back to selling drugs. It was as if I had lost my soul. Eventually, I left that bad boyfriend behind, but not the drug trade. I discovered I was pregnant with my boyfriend's child. I vowed to go straight, but was soon back selling drugs to support myself. Arrested for drug possession, I was forced to ask my parents to take temporary custody of my son. They went ballistic at first, but I was their daughter and they did what they could to support me and my child. I begged God so many times to help me get sober, but my contrarian spirit was just too strong. Deep inside, I refused to give my life to God the way I had given my life to drugs and addiction. That's when I wound up at Deliverance Alley. I was homeless, just released from another stint behind bars, and ready to forget my troubles by getting righteously high. Night was falling, and I figured I was out of last chances. It was 2007. Deliverance Alley was a popular spot for addicts. There was an old sofa on the grass and a bucket for a bathroom. A bunch of my drug-using friends were there, and they welcomed me back. I sat on the couch
prepped my crack pipe, raised it to my lips. Out of nowhere, a voice spoke in my mind. "Say goodbye to all this, Rhonda." I jumped up, looked around. Was somebody playing a trick on me? The voice spoke again. Same words, even louder, clearer. I freaked out. I ran across the street. I looked back at the vacant lot, and I didn't recognize it. As if I'd been transported to another place. Some kind of powerful presence seemed to come down and root my feet to the sidewalk. I heard people speaking. "Queen, you all right?" That was my street name. Everything seemed far away. I took the drugs out of my pocket and handed them to someone. It was as if I had let go of something more than just the drugs. I felt a warmth enfold me. I broke down weeping. The presence freed my feet and directed my steps to a place called Dallas International Street Church. They run a one-year residential discipleship program that includes counseling and addiction recovery. I laid down my contrarian spirit, admitted I was powerless, and surrendered myself to that life-giving program. To this day, I can't explain how it all happened, only that I felt as if my soul had been freed. Fast forward 17 years. I am sober, married, and the founder of an organization called Making It Count, Inc., which offers housing and street support services to people like I once was, lost, homeless, and wondering if there's any hope left for them. I help them see there is. I reconcile with my child and my parents. Before my dad died in 2015, I made amends for the ways I had hurt him, including that mean letter I'd sent him in Vietnam. I came to accept that for a man like him, strict discipline was the way he best knew to show love. I forgave him for that. I am also grateful to him. I believe it was the military discipline he instilled in me that enabled me to form the daily responsibilities that helped me stick with recovery. God guided me, but I had to do the work. I run Making It Count, Inc. the same way. Guests in my sober living house do chores, keep their rooms spotless, and stick to a schedule. As an active addict, the only structure in your life is getting the next fix. Recovering addicts need new structures. Being contrarian and questioning the status quo are necessary sometimes. Addiction recovery is not one of those times. My guests sometimes chafe at my discipline. In the long run, they are grateful, just as I am. In recovery, surrender equals freedom. Since Making It Count, Inc. was founded in 2010, we have distributed more than 100,000 meals, 75,000 hygiene kits, and 12,500 coats to people who need them. We partner with churches and other regional service providers. Every Wednesday, we launder people's clothes for free. We have been recognized by numerous Dallas civic organizations, and I recently received a Community Service Award from the Greater North Dallas Business and Professional Women's Club. I give all the credit to God and my tireless volunteers. Making It Count, Inc. is now in the process of designing and getting permits for our new headquarters. I envision a full-service resource center for the homeless people struggling with the substance use, a place of love, acceptance, and pathways to recovery. I'm sometimes asked if it is possible to get sober without bringing God into your life. I suppose it might be, but that hasn't been my experience.
It was God who spoke to me that day at Deliverance Alley and moved my feet and soul in the right direction. There is no other explanation. Guess where I plan to locate that headquarters? That's right, Deliverance Alley. My husband and I recently bought that vacant lot. We do street ministry there now. I can't wait until the building goes up and we can begin offering deliverance on a major scale. Like I said, there is always hope. There is always another chance. That's God's promise. And God always delivers on his promises. And our next story is under Neighbor to Neighbor, the Apple Pie Solution. They say good fences make good neighbors. What happens when neighbors can't agree on a fence? By Jeannie Hughes of Hurricane, West Virginia. Our next door neighbors stood on our front porch. We want to attach a chain link fence to your white vinyl one, the wife said. That's not going to work, my husband Roger said, shaking his head. Our fence is inside the property line. We need to mow and trim between the two fences. That's ridiculous, the husband said, his voice rising. We have every right to put our fence on the edge of our property. Before we could respond, the couple stormed off. So much for the times you sat out here with him talking politics, I said to Roger. And to think we helped her with yard work last year when he was out of town, Roger said. From that point on, our neighbors refused to acknowledge our wave's hello. I tried to forget about the argument, but then they had the gall to start letting their dog use our unfenced front yard to do his business. I couldn't help but think of what Robert Frost once wrote. Good fences make good neighbors. A few weeks later, I was out shopping for a replacement for my broken butter dish when I noticed a display of pie plates. The ivory one on top of the stack had Love Thy Neighbor spelled out in blue. Okay, God, I said, I get the message. I bought the plate and loaded up Granny Smith apples. That afternoon, as I rolled out the dough for the pie, I prayed that it wouldn't tear and that the top of the bottom crust wouldn't separate. I wanted my piece pie to be perfect. I hope they'll accept my gesture, I told Roger. Maybe I'm putting too much faith in my baking. Once the pie had cooled, I headed next door. I almost chickened out and turned back, but then forced myself to ring the doorbell. I could hear their terrier start barking like crazy. Please let it be the wife and not the husband who comes out, I whispered. The door opened. It was the wife. Hi, I baked this apple pie for you, I said. She reached out and silently took the pie from my hands. Please keep the plate, I sputtered. She just looked at me for a moment, then slowly closed the door. I walked back to our house. Oddly enough, I didn't feel rejected at all. Quite the opposite. In fact, I envisioned the wife slicing into the pie and discovering Love Thy Neighbor written across the bottom of the dish. Hopefully, that message would get through. A few days later, I was out in the front yard when the wife passed me in her truck. My hand shot up in greeting. She returned my wave. I ran into our house and found Roger. She waved back at me. And you were worried your apple pie wasn't good, he said. Still, we weren't surprised when the husband put up a chain link fence right in the property line. Although we can't trim the fences, we didn't say anything to the neighbors. It just didn't seem worth damaging our relationship further. Maybe even bad fences can make good neighbors. Meanwhile, the wife keeps waving and even says hello. Her husband still shuns us, but that's okay.
I'll keep following those heavenly nudges, even though restoring our neighborly relationship might seem like a pie in the sky.
I will now be reading from the May issue of Reader's Digest. The first story is under the Healthy Wellness from thehealthy.com. Eye health epidemic. What's behind the sharp increase in nearsightedness? By Rebecca Gayo. Roughly 42% of Americans are nearsighted today, compared with 25% in 1971. The World Health Organization, WHO, predicts that about half of the world's population will have myopia, or nearsightedness, by 2050. It's clear that our vision is becoming increasingly blurry, but researchers are only now beginning to understand why. Generally, a childhood phenomenon, myopia, happens when the eyeball grows too long from the front to the back, taking on more of an oval shape versus a sphere. Eyes have a stop signal so that they grow proportionately with the head, explains Gregory Schwartz, an associate professor at the Departments of Ophthalmology and Neuroscience at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwest University. However, that signal can be interrupted by genetic and environmental factors, which leads to our eyeballs growing a bit too much, making them too big for the optics, the lens and the cornea, which are responsible for focusing your vision. The mismatch between the eyeballs and the optics leads to far-off objects looking out of focus. Telltale signs you might have myopia also include headaches, as well as eye strain and tiredness when doing certain activities such as driving or playing sports. While our first instinct is to blame the increased use of screens, experts believe the real reason is not that exactly, but it's related, namely less time spent outdoors. Natural light is essential for the healthy eye development, says Schwartz. A 2017 study published in JAMA Ophthalmology found a correlation between increased UVB exposure and a decrease in myopia, particularly in children and young adults. Exposure to natural light stimulates dopamine, which helps regulate normal growth and development of the eyeball. Indoor lighting doesn't seem to do the trick. Ideally, kids should get at least 2 hours of natural light a day. That said, our increased use of screens is a problem. Most screens are high contrast, like black text on a white page or light text on a dark background, says Schwartz. It's still a theory, but some scientists think that the contrast of reading a book or looking at a bright screen in a dark room might be overstimulating our retinas, causing more eye growth in children. A 2018 study in Scientific Records analyze the retinal pathways when looking at black text on white backgrounds compared to natural environments and concluded that the contrast could stimulate myopia. Close work like reading and looking closely at the screens has also been shown to cause myopia. Researchers are working on ways to slow down rising myopia rates. A clinical trial at Ohio State University found that eye drops with a low dose of atropine may slow myopia in kids. There's also some early evidence that a type of contact lenses called peripheral defocus lenses might stop nearsightedness from worsening. Most people's vision will stabilize in their teens, but some people develop myopia later in life, typically between ages 20 and 40. Blurry vision isn't the only downside. People with myopia are at a higher risk of developing eye issues as they age, such as glaucoma, early cataracts, and macular degeneration. That's why regular eye examinations are important. You can also reduce eye strain by making a few simple lifestyle changes, such as ensuring that you are reading or working in good light, soft background light plus a task light, choosing non-glare screens for your computer or TV, and taking frequent breaks. When we spend time looking at a screen, our blink rate decreases from the typical 18 times per minute to 6 to 8 times per minute. This result in significant dry eye and irritation, says Una Rappaport, a board-certified ophthalmologist at Manhattan Eye in New York City. She recommends the following 20-20-20 rule when you're using your computer. Every 20 minutes, look 20 feet away for 20 seconds. She also says that dry eyes and irritation can be treated with the over-the-counter eye drops, ointments, or prescription medications. And of course, always wear your contacts and eyeglasses as prescribed. The next article is under national interest, entitled, I Had to Do It. Americans are living longer, forcing loved ones to make impossible choices about their long-term care, by Reed Abelson and Jordan Rao from the New York Post. Margaret Newcomb, 69, a retired French teacher, is desperately trying to protect her retirement savings by caring for her 82-year-old husband, who has severe dementia, at home in Seattle. She used to fear his disease-induced paranoia, but now he's so frail and confused that he wanders away with no idea of how to find his way home. He gets lost so often that she attaches a tag with her phone number to a shoelace. Phelan Lewis, 36, sacrificed a promising career as a research director in England to return home to Nashville in 2021 after her mother had a debilitating stroke. They ran up $15,000 in medical and credit card debt while Lewis took on the role of caretaker. Millions of families are facing such daunting life choices and potential financial ruin as the escalating costs of in-home care, assisted living facilities, and nursing homes devour the savings and incomes of older Americans and their relatives. People are exposed to the possibility of depleting almost all their wealth, says Richard W. Johnson, director of the Program on Retirement Policy at the Urban Institute, a nonprofit think tank. The prospect of dying broke looms as an imminent threat for the baby boomer generation, which vastly expanded the middle class and looked hopefully towards a comfortable retirement on the backbone of pensions and 401ks. Roughly 10,000 boomers will turn 65 every day until 2030. Many expect to live into their 80s and 90s as the price tag for long-term care explodes, outpacing inflation and reaching nearly $500 billion a year, according to federal researchers. The challenges will only grow. By 2050, the population of Americans ages 65 and older is projected to increase by more than 50% to 86 million. According to census estimates, the number of people 85 or older will nearly triple to 19 million. The United States has no coherent system of long-term care. It's mostly a patchwork. The private market, where a minuscule portion of families buy long-term care insurance, has shriveled, reduced over the years of giant rate hikes by insurers that had underestimated how much care people would actually use. Labor shortages have left families searching for workers willing to care for their elders in their homes, and the cost of a spot in the assisted living facility has soared to an unaffordable level for most middle-class Americans. They have to run out of money to qualify for nursing home care paid for by the government. About 8 million people, ages 65 and over, reported that they had dementia or difficulty with basic daily tasks, like bathing and feeding themselves. And nearly 3 million of them had no assistance at all, according to a federally funded study which surveyed elderly people about their long-term care needs and financial resources. Most people relied on spouses, children, grandchildren, or friends. The United States devotes a smaller share of its gross domestic product to long-term care than do most other wealthy countries, including Britain, France, Canada, Germany, Sweden, and Japan, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The United States lags behind its international peers in another way. It dedicates far less of its overall health spending toward long-term care. We just don't value the elders the way the other countries and other cultures do, says Rachel M. Werner, executive director of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. We don't have a financing and insurance system for long-term care, she says. There isn't the political will to spend that much money. Despite medical advances that have added years to the average lifespan and allowed people to survive decades more after getting cancer or suffering from heart disease or strokes, federal long-term care for older people has not fundamentally changed in the decades since President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid into law in 1965. From 1960 to 2021, the number of Americans ages 85 and older increased at more than six times the rate of the general population, according to census records. Medicare, the federal health insurance program for Americans ages 65 and older, covers the cost of medical care, but generally pays for a home aid or a stay in a nursing home only for a limited time during a recovery from a surgery or a fall, or for short-term rehabilitation. Medicaid, the federal state program, covers long-term care, usually in a nursing home, but only for the poor. Middle-class people must exhaust their assets to qualify, forcing them to sell much of their property to empty their bank accounts. If they go into a nursing home, they are permitted to keep a pittance of their retirement income, $60 or less a month in most states, and spouses can hold on to only a modest amount of income and assets, often leaving their children and grandchildren to shoulder some of the financial burden. You basically want people to destitute themselves, and then you take everything else that they have, says Gay Glenn, whose mother lived in a nursing home in Kansas until she died last October at the age of 96. Her mother, Betty Mae Glenn, had to spend down her savings, paying the home more than $10,000 a month, until she qualified for Medicaid. Gay, 61, relocated from Chicago to Topeka more than 4 years ago, moving into one of her mother's two rental properties and overseeing her care and finances. Under the state Medicaid program, Byzantine rules, she had to pay rent to her mother, and that income went towards her mother's care. Gay sold the family house just before her mother's death. Her lawyer told her the estate had to pay Medicaid back about $20,000 from the proceeds. At any given time, skilled nursing homes house roughly 630,000 older residents whose average age is about 77, according to recent estimates. A long-term residence care can easily cost more than $100,000 a year without Medicaid coverage at these institutions, which are supposed to provide round-the-clock nursing coverage. According to a public opinion poll by KFF, formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, 9 out of 10 people said it would be impossible or very difficult to pay that much. Efforts to create a national long-term care system have repeatedly collapsed. Democrats have argued that the federal government needs to take a much stronger hand in subsidizing care. In the Medicaid program, demand was clearly outstripped supply, according to recent analysis. While the number of home aides in the Medicaid program has increased to 1.4 million in 2019 from 840,000 in 2008, the number of aides per 100 people who qualify for home or community care has declined nearly 12%. The labor shortages are largely attributed to low wages for difficult work. The Biden administration sought to improve wages and working conditions for paid caregivers, but a $150 billion proposal in the 2021 Build Back Better Act for an in-home and community-based services under Medicaid was dropped to lower the bill's price tag. This is an issue that is coming to the front door of members of Congress, says Senator Bob Casey, Democrat of Pennsylvania, and the chair of the Senate Special Committee on Aging. No matter where you're representing, if you're representing a blue state or a red state, families are not going to settle for just having one option, he says, referring to nursing homes funded under Medicaid. The federal government has got to do its part, which it hasn't. But leading Republicans in Congress say the federal government cannot be expected to step in more than it already does. Americans need to save for when they will inevitably need care, says Senator Michael Braun of Indiana, the ranking Republican on the Aging Committee. So often people just think it's just going to work out, he says. Too many people get to the point where they're 65, then say, I don't have that much there. Boomers are jogging and cycling into retirement, equipped with hip and knee replacements that have slowed their aging, and they are loath to enter the institutional setting of a nursing home. But they face major expenses for the in-between years when many fall along a spectrum between good health and needing round-the-clock care in a nursing home. That has led many to assisted living centers run by for-profit companies and private equity funds, which are enjoying robust profits in this growing market. Some 850,000 people, ages 65 or older, now live in these facilities, which are largely ineligible for federal funds and run the gamut, with some providing only basics such as help getting dressed and taking medication, and others offering luxury amenities like day trips, gourmet meals, yoga, and spas. The bills can be staggering. Half of the nation's assisted living facilities cost at least $54,000 a year, according to Genworth, a long-term care insurer. That rises substantially in many metropolitan areas with lofty real estate prices. Specialized settings like locked memory care units for those with dementia can cost twice as much. Home care is costly too. Agencies charge about $27 an hour for a home health aide. Hiring someone who spends 6 or 7 hours a day cleaning and helping an older person get out of bed or take medications can add up to $60,000 a year.
As Americans live longer, the number who develop dementia has soared, as have their needs. An estimated 5 million to 7 million Americans over age 65 have dementia, and their ranks are projected to grow to nearly 12 million by 2040. The condition robs people of their memories, mars the ability to speak and understand, and can alter their personalities. In Seattle, Margaret and Tim Newcomb sleep on separate floors of their two-story cottage, with Margaret ever mindful that her husband, who has dementia, can hallucinate and become aggressive if medication fails to tame his symptoms. "The anger has diminished from the early days," she says, "but early on she resorted to calling the police when he acted erratically. He was hating me and angry, and I didn't feel safe," she says. She considered memory care units, but the least expensive option cost around $8,000 a month, and the price for some facilities could reach nearly twice that amount. The couple's monthly income, with his pension from Seattle City Light, a utility company, and their combined Social Security, is $6,000. They, placing her husband in such a facility would have gutted the $500,000 they had saved before she retired from 35 years of teaching art and French at a parochial school. "I'll let go of everything if I have to, but it's a very unfair system," she says. "If you didn't see ahead or didn't have the right type of job that provides for you, it's tough luck." In the last year or two, medication has quelled Tim's anger, and his health has also declined so much that he no longer poses a physical threat. Margaret says she reconciled to caring for him as long as she can. "When I see him sitting out on the porch and appreciating the sun coming on his face, it's really sweet," she says. The financial threat posed by dementia also weighs heavily on adult children who have become guardians of their aged parents and have watched their slow, expensive declines. Claudia Morell, 65, of Parkville, Maryland, estimated that her mother, Regine Hayes, spent more than $1 million during the 8 years she needed residential care for dementia. That was possible only because her mother had two pensions, one from her husband's military service and another from his job at an insurance company, plus savings and Social Security. As her mother's guardian, Morell paid the required legal fees, as well as $6,000 on a special bed so her mother wouldn't fall out, and more on private aids after she suffered repeated small strokes. Her mother died last December at age 87. As awful as it may sound, her mother was lucky. "I will never have those kinds of resources," said Morell, an educational consultant. "My children will never have these kinds of resources. We didn't inherit enough or aren't going to earn enough to have the quality of care she got. You certainly can't live that way on Social Security." For 7 years, Annie Reed, excuse me, abandoned her life in Colorado to sleep in her childhood bedroom in Maryland, living out her suitcase and caring for her mother, Frances Sampogna, who had dementia. "No one else in my family was able to do this," she said. "It dawned on me I have to actually unpack and live here," Reed, 62, remembers thinking. "And how long? There's no timeline on it." After Sampogna died at the end of September 2021, her daughter returned to Colorado and started a furniture redesign business, a craft she had taught herself in her mother's basement. Reed recently had her knee replaced, something she could not do in Maryland because her insurance didn't cover doctors there.
Studies are now calculating the toll of caregiving on children, especially women. The median lost wages for women providing intensive care for their mothers is $24,500 over 2 years. According to a study led by Norma Coe, an associate professor at the Perelman School for Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, Phelan Lewis moved back from England to Nashville to care for her mother, a former nurse who had a stroke that put her in a wheelchair. She is also tending to her elderly grandfather, who is ill with prostate cancer and kidney disease. "I was thrust back into caregiving role full time." She gave up a post as a research director for a nonprofit organization. Making up for lost income seems daunting when she continues to support her mother, but she is regaining hope. She is promoted to assistant dean for the student affairs at Vanderbilt School of Nursing and is recently married. She and her husband plan to stay in the same apartment with her mother until they can save enough to move into a larger place. Well, that's all we have time for today. This has been Heidi reading the guidepost and Reader's Digest. See you next time.